Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Something mysterious plagues County Mayo on the west coast of Ireland and its legendary Gaelic football team.
Sometimes I think there's something sinister going on.
I believe in the curse. I think it's real.
Listen to the curious tale of the Mayo Curse on Amazing Sports Stories from the BBC World Service. Search for Amazing Sports Stories wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. I'm Janet Jalil, and in the early hours of Tuesday, the 19th of December, these are our main stories. Hamas releases a video of three elderly male hostages being held in Gaza, a move denounced by Israel. More companies have suspended shipping through the Red Sea because of attacks launched from Yemen. The paramilitary rapid support forces in Sudan have reportedly seized control of a city that's been sheltering hundreds of thousands of displaced people. Also in this podcast,
my symptoms improved immensely. And it was just great, a great feeling, not just for me, but for the future, for us women who suffer with it.
A revolutionary new treatment to reduce the misery of menopause. Hamas has released a video of three elderly men being held hostage in Gaza. Two of them are in their 80s and one is 79. One of them speaks to the camera about how they're suffering greatly in very harsh conditions. He calls for their release, saying, "We don't want to be casualties of an airstrike." Israel has previously condemned such videos as psychological warfare. Daniel Hagari, a spokesman for the Israeli army, was quick to denounce this latest one.
The video that Hamas released in the past hours is a criminal terror video. It testifies to Hamas's cruelty towards innocent, very elderly civilians who are in need of medical care. Chaim, Yoram and Amiram, I hope you can hear me this evening. Know that we are doing everything we can to bring you back safely. Some of your families are already home, and we will not rest until you return as well.
The video was released shortly after the U.S. Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin met Israeli leaders on his second visit to Israel since Hamas's deadly attacks on October the 7th. At a news conference in Tel Aviv with his Israeli counterpart, he said America's support for Israel remained unshakable, but also called on it to do more to avoid civilian deaths in Gaza.
Protecting Palestinian civilians in Gaza is both a moral duty and a strategic imperative. So we will continue to stand up for Israel's bedrock right to defend itself. And we will also continue to urge the protection of civilians during conflict, and to increase the flow of humanitarian aid into Gaza. That's important as Israel fights to dismantle the Hamas terrorist infrastructure in Gaza. And it will also be crucial for our work with our allies and partners after the fighting stops.
More than 100 hostages are being held in Gaza. The Hamas-run health ministry in Gaza says more than 19,000 people have now been killed by Israel's military. It says 40% of the victims are children. One of the latest to die was a 13-year-old girl, Dina Abu Mohsen, who was being treated in hospital after having her leg amputated. She'd recorded a video pleading for help after losing her parents and her siblings in an earlier Israeli strike. The Israeli Defense Minister, Yoav Gallant, so the U.S. knew his country was going to great lengths to avoid hitting civilians.
We both know the complexities of war. We both fought brutal terrorist organizations. We know that it takes time. Unlike our enemies, we are defending our values and we operate according to international law. The IDF is operating to minimize the harm to civilian population.
This is disputed by groups like Human Rights Watch. It's accused Israel of using starvation of civilians as a weapon in its war against Hamas. The group said by blocking deliveries of food, water and fuel, Israel's actions could constitute a war crime. These Palestinians described what life had become like in Gaza.
I've been displaced to Maghazi camp. I've been displaced more than once, but this time we settled at Camp Maghazi. I'm talking to you right now as there's constant bombardment. I want to state something. The aid that arrives is not enough because we have a large number of children and we as citizens of Gaza largely depend on this aid, which is an essential, delivered from our neighbouring countries, either Egypt or any neighbouring country.
My name is Oday, living in the district of Gaza, and there is an ongoing war on Gaza. I got to the supermarket and I can't find anything. I can't find biscuits, I can't find chips, I can't find anything, and I want chips and biscuits.
Mr. Austin's visit comes days after President Biden warned that Israel risked losing the international support that it had won after the October the 7th attack by Hamas that killed 1,200 people. Our correspondent in Jerusalem, Frank Gardner, said the US Defense Secretary was trying to strike a delicate balance.
Well, I think he was probably under instructions to kind of be quite placatory, at least in public, with Israel. Certainly they went to some lengths to show a kind of a united stand. He was very clear that America's support for Israel was rock solid and that he had no greater friend, etc., and that Israel would not be alone. He did say democracies are stronger when they stick to the rule of law, or words to that effect. It's no secret that the US wants Israel to move to a different phase, to a less intensive phase. In other words, to change the way it's fighting this war from intensive bombardment of airstrikes and artillery strikes and drone strikes to far more kind of finely tuned special forces raids, more focused actions. I'm not sure that either, frankly, is going to yield the results that Israel has set itself out to achieve in this war, which is to eliminate Hamas as a fighting force and to get the hostages released. Israel has now, the war cabinet has now authorized the head of Israel's intelligence service to explore a second round of negotiations with the Qataris. So to come back to your question, quite an interesting comment from Yoav Gallant, who is the Israeli defense minister, who said that Israel is not going to be providing the civil administration of Gaza. There's a lot of discussion here about who is going to run Gaza, and that's not clear.
Yes, absolutely, because at some point this conflict has to end, and we're seeing this big difference between the US. It wants to return to the two-state solution, whereas Israel is talking about getting rid of Hamas, but it's equally opposed to Fatah, the Palestinian Authority that governs parts of the West Bank, also taking control of Gaza.
I mean, Fatah is very discredited, the Palestinian Authority. They are seen as corrupt, old, inefficient, unpopular, partly because they failed to produce the promised results, which is not entirely their fault. But then again, you know, the rest of the Middle East, the Gulf Arab states, if you remember, they signed the Abraham Accords a few years ago with Israel because they got fed up with waiting for the Palestinian Authority to actually sort of deliver on a peace deal. But I'm afraid I'm fairly pessimistic long term about the chances of peace holding, even if they have a ceasefire, because Hamas, you can destroy their weapons, you can blow up their tunnels, you can get rid of their arsenals, and you can kill their fighters. But you can't kill an ideology unless you've got a better one. And in the absence of the promise of a proper sovereign Palestinian state, it's going to be very hard to steer all those thousands of angry young men in Gaza, and the West Bank for that matter, away from a path of violence if you can't offer them a viable alternative, because they are fed up with the current situation in the West Bank, the settlers. And this was something that Lloyd Austin did condemn, the violence by these now quite heavily armed settlers, Israeli settlers, who are colonizing what should be the future land of the Palestinian state that they've been promised in the peace talks. Long term, poles apart. Hamas doesn't want Israel to exist, and this Israeli government doesn't really, or at least elements of it, do not believe in a two-state solution.
Frank Gardner in Jerusalem. The oil giant BP and the shipping company Evergreen have joined some of the world's other leading freight operators in suspending routes through the Red Sea. Attacks on vessels by Iranian-backed Houthi rebels in Yemen, which began after the war in Gaza, have now increased to a nearly daily basis. Many ships are being rerouted around the Cape of Good Hope to avoid the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. The US has promised to form an international coalition to protect merchant shipping in the Red Sea from attacks by the Houthi rebels. The US Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin said he'd convened a meeting on Tuesday to discuss how to tackle the issue.
These attacks are reckless, dangerous, and they violate international law. And so we're taking action to build an international coalition to address this threat. And I would remind you that this is not just a U.S. issue. This is an international problem, and it deserves an international response.
The Red Sea is a vital route for freight travelling between the Asian and European markets. Sam Fenwick spoke to Guy Platten, the Secretary General at the International Chamber of Shipping, one of the world's principal shipping organisations. So how serious is the situation?
It's very serious. We've had seen numerous attacks on merchant ships and, you know, we've been deploring the actions of the Houthis in the strongest possible terms, and we need to see the immediate cessation of these attacks because these acts of aggression threaten the lives of innocent seafarers and, of course, the safety of the merchant of merchant shipping and a flagrant breach of international law. So we take this very seriously. And as your report says, a number of the major container lines have now paused traffic going through the Red Sea and rediverting them. We heard that BP is, and we know many other companies are considering their position at the moment. So for the industry, this is very serious indeed, and we want to see stability returned.
I want to ask you about shipping routes in a moment, but just explain to us what type of attacks these are. I understand some are using drones.
Yeah, we've seen drones and I think there's been some missile attacks as well. Luckily, there's been no one hurt, and I think that's one thing we can hold on to. But it's only a matter of time, and it's, I think, is why companies are taking the difficult decision to reroute their ships, because they have to think of the safety of their seafarers as a primary concern.
So it doesn't mean that ships are not moving. They're taking different routes that might be a longer way round. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. So the shortest route in terms of trade routes between Europe and Asia is through the Red Sea and the Suez Canal. And we saw when the Ever Given ran aground in the Suez Canal in March 21, that then causes a blockage in that route. So the only other way round is to go around the Cape of Good Hope, which adds between 6 and 14 days to a voyage, depending on the ship type, and an additional 9,000 kilometres. So it's not going to stop trade, but it's going to disrupt it and it's going to delay things.
And what sort of freight goes through this particular area? I mean, BP have said that they're stopping their ships using this particular route. So oil is an obvious one. But what other things go through it?
So it'll be oil, it'll be gas, it'll be containers, so, you know, general goods. Just about everything which is going between Asia and Europe will pass through the Red Sea. And I think, as your report said, 12% of global trade, you know, $3 to $6 billion a day goes through that, you know, $1.4 trillion a year through that sort of sea. So it's an absolutely key strategic waterway.
Guy Platten, the Secretary General at the International Chamber of Shipping. There are fears of a widening humanitarian catastrophe in Sudan as the paramilitary rapid support forces, who've been fighting the army since April, have reportedly captured a city south of Khartoum. Wad Madani was a safe haven for hundreds of thousands of people who had fled the capital. Our Africa regional editor, Will Ross, reports.
Terrified residents of Wad Madani say gunmen from Sudan's paramilitary rapid support forces have spread out across the city. The RSF has an appalling reputation for human rights abuses, and there are reports that looting has already begun. People have been trying to get out of the city, but that's not easy. There's a fuel shortage, and there are gunmen along the roads. International efforts to stop this war have all failed. The army leadership and the RSF have chosen to fight on. Since April, nearly 7 million people have been displaced. Now it's impossible to know where is safe in Sudan.
Will Ross, a senior Ukrainian commander, says the country is scaling back some military operations because of a shortfall in foreign defence aid. Brigadier General Oleksandr Tarnevsky was speaking as talks in the US continue to try to unlock a multi-billion dollar package which has been stalled by Republicans in Congress. Jessica Parker reports from Kyiv.
These are frank admissions from Oleksandr Tarnevsky, even if much of what he said is widely known. Speaking to Reuters, he acknowledged ammunition shortages and said that in some areas, troops were moving into defensive mode. The Brigadier General, who's in charge of a large stretch of the front line, said help from the West was still arriving, but that it was not enough.
The volumes that we have today are not sufficient for us, given our needs. So we are redistributing it. We are replanning tasks that we had set for ourselves and making them smaller.
A $60 billion US defense aid package remains stuck because of congressional wrangling. Nevertheless, Oleksandr Tarnavsky said Ukraine would not give up, even hinting at further large-scale actions in future. The EU will attempt to unlock crucial economic aid for Ukraine at a newly announced summit in February, after the package was blocked by the Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban last week.
Jessica Parker. This year, Russia's elite marine unit, the 155th, was nearly wiped out on the front line in Ukraine. A year ago, these same soldiers, also known as the Black Berets, were warning that they were being slaughtered. The Russian authorities denied the number of losses. But a BBC Eye investigation can now show how glaring tactical mistakes cost young Russian marines their lives, despite repeated warnings. Vicky Areklian reports.
25-year-old Ramaz Gorgadze rep career was just taking off on TikTok when he was called up to fight in President Putin's war in Ukraine. Before leaving the small village in Russia's Far East region, where he had grown up, he said goodbye to his mother and wrote a song about the conflict. In September last year, Ramaz joined the elite 155th Marine Brigade, also known as the Black Berets. This unit was accused by the Ukrainians of war crimes in Bucha earlier that year.
Hi, Mom. We've arrived at the grounds. We are checking our inventory. They haven't fed us yet. Nothing is really clear.
Ramaz was now 7,000 kilometers away from his mother in the Donetsk region of Donbass. Ramaz sent a last message to his mother before heading to the front.
Now we are moving to the checkpoints near the front line. Love you. Keep your fingers crossed. Don't worry too much. I'll be careful.
Ramaz's first mission, the battle for the towns of Pavlivka and Volodar, was a death trap.
We came under so much fire, so many corpses. Guys were just torn in two near me. It's worse than hell.
Testimonies like this started to appear online, and by November, a letter written by the Black Berets to their regional governor, Oleg Kozhemyaka, went viral. They accused inept commanders of throwing them into an incomprehensible offensive where they lost 300 men in just 4 days. The soldiers also asked for an independent investigation, but their claims were denied by Governor Kozhemyaka.
Yes, there are losses. There's heavy fighting going on, but there are far fewer than what they say in the appeal.
BBCI can now reveal this battle was one of the highest concentrations of losses for a single Russian unit since the beginning of the war. But why? We've analyzed hundreds of hours of battle footage and found the Russian troops making catastrophic errors on the ground. Typhoon Özberk worked alongside Russian Marines during his career as a Turkish naval officer. We showed him videos of the battle to understand the Russian behavior in the field.
They didn't apply the fundamentals of land warfare in these videos, and they're just sending the troops from a narrow line to the death without mine clearance operation, without air reconnaissance operation, without enough intelligence supported with thermal and other electro-optical imaging. Such kind of breaching operations are suicide.
An investigation by the Russian military prosecutor into the fate of the Black Berets, published 5 weeks after their appeal to Governor Kozhemyaka, found no wrongdoing by their commanders. By December, Svetlana, the mother of the young rapper Ramaz, had not heard from her son for weeks, and, desperate to find him, she and several other family members traveled 7,000 kilometers to the Donetsk region. There she found her answer. Ramaz was dead. He had been killed in the battle by a drone strike. In late January 2023, Russia tried to take Volodar again, launching the largest assault on the town since the beginning of the war. Again, the Marines of the 155th Brigade were involved. Again, the men were caught in a death trap. Again, they raised the alarm in a second letter. When President Putin was asked about the fate of the Marines, this is what he responded.
Marine infantry is working properly, right now, and fighting heroically, both Pacific and Northern Fleet.
Neither the Russian Ministry of Defense nor Governor Kozhemyaka responded to the second appeal. We contacted Governor Kozhemyaka about our findings, but he did not respond. 1 year later, Volodar, or it's left of it, is still a contested battlefield.
That report by Vicky Araklian. Still to come.
When the holiday season rolls around, Dave Giambri's candy shop in Clementon, New Jersey, is bustling. Customers come for the candy canes.
But confectionery companies in the US aren't quite as festive as usual. The price of sugar has gone up.
Some people play golf on the weekends. I hunt con artists.
Unmissable podcasts from the BBC World Service.
Are County Mayo a great team blighted by mystical forces we can't comprehend?
I believe in the curse. I think it's real.
Telling stories from around the globe.
Every minute there's bombing and shelling. There is no safety. If I get any internet connection, I'll talk to you again.
Search for Lives Less Ordinary, Amazing Sports Stories, and The Documentary, wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You better be ready, because we're going to bring it to you.
Welcome back to the Global News Podcast. A female serial killer in China has been executed more than 20 years after she and her boyfriend worked together to murder seven people. Our China media analyst, Kerry Allen, told us more about a case that has horrified but also gripped much of China.
Lao Rongzhi, she's become a notorious figure in China because her and her then boyfriend Fa Ziying, they carried out a series of robberies, kidnappings and killings in four Chinese provinces in the late 90s. And so they kind of became dubbed a Chinese Bonnie and Clyde. They moved around carrying out these horrific acts. And she spent two decades on the run. Her boyfriend, Fa Ziying, he was caught and executed back in 1999. But she was only arrested in 2019. And today, yes, she's been executed.
And why has she been executed only now, 4 years after she was finally caught?
There are a number of reasons for this. Things have changed a lot since the 90s in China. First of all, when she was captured, it was just before the global pandemic began. So there were lockdowns in place in China. China had zero COVID measures that were very, very strict in the country. So things like legal proceedings, that there were delays anyway. But also as well, in the 90s in China, when suspects were arrested and charged, it was very quickly that executions would be carried out. And there have been criticisms since that some were carried out after police officers tortured people in detention. So now they take a bit longer. There are appeals in China. So that is another reason that it's taken a long time to happen.
The story about her execution has really dominated Chinese media today.
It has, yes. It's very rare that you would hear of a female Chinese serial killer in the country. This is why she's been such a notorious figure. And also as well in media, a lot of people saw that while she was on the run, they've seen pictures in newspapers of her time when she was living under various identities. She was working as a waitress. This one picture that's been circulated quite widely shows her wearing a Santa hat and a short dress. It looks like she's having fun. She was quite young at the time of the offences. She was only in her 20s and she was 49 when she was executed.
And she did try to claim in her defence that she'd been coerced.
She did, yes. Media have said that she was raped by her former boyfriend and that she basically hero worshipped him and that this played a role in the crimes. But I've also seen reports in state media saying that she was responsible for picking targets at entertainment venues and then getting her boyfriend to attack them. And also as well, I think why this has been such a horrific case for Chinese people to read about is that in one case in particular, after a man was murdered, the couple went to the victim's residence and they also murdered not only his wife, but his 2-year-old daughter. One thing that I am seeing a lot of today in Chinese media are reports that she spoke to some of the relatives of victims and very much did want to show her remorse.
Kerry Allen. Thousands of tractors have blocked the centre of the German capital, Berlin, in a protest against new environmental regulations and the price of diesel. Rachel Wright reports.
As many as 6,000 tractors brought the area around the Brandenburg Gate to a halt, with some dumping manure on the road. The president of the German Farmers Association warned the government that if it didn't withdraw its proposed measures to remove tax breaks and subsidies for diesel, the farmers would demonstrate on January the 8th in a way the country has never experienced before. Last week, the federal government announced plans to save around $1 billion after a constitutional court ruled its plans to pay off its debt were unconstitutional. The ruling blew a hole in government spending plans and plunged Olaf Scholz's three-way coalition into turmoil.
Rachel Wright. The Roman Catholic Church has granted approval for priests to perform blessings for same-sex couples. It said they must not be linked to weddings or civil unions and would not be part of regular church rituals. But the decision still marks a significant change in policy, as Sophia Petitzer explains.
Just 2 years ago, the Catholic Church said it could not bless same-sex couples, as God does not bless sin. But Pope Francis has approved a document that will allow priests to administer a blessing to LGBT couples, as long as it is not part of regular church rituals or liturgies. The Vatican made it clear the development does not change its position on marriage, which it continues to consider as a union between a man and a woman. While some will view the decision as narrow in scope, it represents a significant shift, given that the Catholic Church continues to teach that homosexual acts are sinful. But since he was elected Pope 10 years ago, Francis has sought to adopt a more inclusive approach towards LGBT people, much to the disdain of conservative cardinals. The Vatican said the ruling should be seen as a sign that God welcomes all.
Sophia Bittiza. A drug that aims to prevent hot flushes during the menopause has been approved for use in the UK. The non-hormonal treatment may benefit women for whom HRT is not suitable, although it's not yet available on the publicly funded National Health Service or NHS. The drug is already in use in the US, where a monthly treatment costs over $500. One of the scientists who led pioneering trials of the drug called it a game-changing blockbuster. Here's our medical editor, Fergus Walsh.
Up to 8 in 10 women going through the menopause experience hot flushes and night sweats. The new drug called Veozah, also known as fezolinetant, works by blocking a protein in the brain involved in regulating body temperature. It could be suitable for women who can't take HRT, such as those with a history of cancer or blood clots. Elaine Barker, who's 68, was on a trial of this type of compound, and the daily tablet made a huge difference.
My symptoms improved immensely, and it's just great, a great feeling, not just for me, but for the future, for us women who suffer with it.
The drug doesn't deal with other symptoms of the menopause, such as fatigue and mood swings. Common side effects include diarrhea and insomnia. Veozah is now licensed for private prescription, but the health body NICE is not due to assess it for the NHS until next summer.
Fergus Walsh. Now to the United States. Bonbons and red and white candy canes dominate the holiday season there. But confectionery companies aren't feeling quite as festive as normal this year because the price of making their sweets has risen. And that in turn means customers are paying more, as our North America business correspondent Erin Delmore reports.
When the holiday season rolls around, Dave Giambri's candy shop in Clementon, New Jersey, is bustling. Customers come for the candy canes.
$38.05 altogether for you.
Dave's candy canes are made almost entirely of sugar, and all are made by hand. The sugar mix is folded and prodded and twisted into that famous red and white pattern. As we mold the sweet treats, Dave tells me that his main ingredient is now costing him more.
This year I did have a slight 4 to 5% increase on the final product. I want to say sugar went up maybe 15% from last year.
He's not the only one feeling the pinch. The cost of sugar is rising worldwide, and it's rising in the U.S., where protectionist policy props up domestic producers. The U.S. is the world's fifth largest sugar producer, with sugar cane grown in the south and sugar beets in the north. The U.S. is also a top consumer. To
find out more about that, we went to the land of Mardi Gras and jazz bands. Why? Because Louisiana is also the home of sugarcane. We drove an hour and a half west of New Orleans to visit one farm.
Louisiana is the northernmost point where sugarcane is grown commercially. We're about a mile away from the Mississippi River, and thousands of years of flooding left naturally occurring fertile topsoil, perfect for growing sugarcane.
My name is Patrick Frischerts. I'm a sugarcane farmer in Plaquemine, Louisiana.
So how does sugar go from being something that you grow here to something that I go to the store and I pick up out of a box on the shelf?
We'll plant a whole stalk in the ground, and the following year we'll go through with a billet harvester, harvest that cane. So this is a John Deere CH570 sugarcane billet harvester. All it does is cut sugarcane. It goes into an 18-wheeler, goes to the mill, and the mill presses the juice out of that sugarcane, that stalk of sugarcane.
The mill is the middleman between the farm and the refinery. It's where the sugar cane starts to look like the sugar we keep in our kitchens.
My name is Charlie Schudmack. I'm the chief operating officer of Cora Texas Sugar Mill, and we're in White Castle, Louisiana. Sugarcane's like a sponge. You have to wet it and squeeze it, except it's stubborn. It doesn't want to give out that juice, so it takes about 800 tons of force on top of the cane to squeeze all that juice out.
The Department of Agriculture protects domestic sugar production from foreign competition by taxing imports. A report by the Government Accountability Office in October found that the sugar program creates higher prices and that Americans pay around twice the world price for sugar. While the sugar farmers benefit, it's not like they don't have other problems.
Last year, we had a very good crop. The problem was input costs were, quite frankly, through the roof. Potassium, for example, $198 a ton went to $1,000 a ton. You have to apply that nutrient to the crop, so you have to take that hit. So the more, even though it could be a great crop with an average or even above average price for your commodity, you're still feeling the squeeze, and there's almost no way to plan for it.
Can a farm like yours compete with foreign sugar?
Our farm and American sugar farmers in general will outcompete anybody in the world. We just can't compete against a farmer receiving direct subsidies.
Back in New Jersey, Dave Giambri's sugar supply is waiting in bags to become one of his famous peppermint candy canes. He's one of the few still making them by hand.
Most of them are made overseas because of the price of sugar and labor. Not many more made in the States. It's a dying art. It really is.
As we watch customers put candy canes and chocolate goodies into their baskets, he tells me he thinks Americans are willing to pay up to satisfy their sweet tooths.
When prices go up, I just increase prices. Gas prices rise up, people still drive. They're still going to buy a candy cane for their tree, whether they pay 10 cents or a dollar for it. It's something that makes Americans feel good.
That report by Erin Delmore. Now to the world of gaming. The makers of the fantasy role-playing game Warhammer have finalized a deal with Amazon to bring the characters and stories to the big screen. As our gaming correspondent Laura Kress reports, the aim is to create a cinematic universe to rival that of the Marvel comics.
Warhammer is getting the star treatment.
Victory. That is what the preachers cry from the spire.
The popular fantasy tabletop game was created in London in 1983 by game designers and friends Brian Ansell, Richard Halliwell and Rick Priestley. It involves players simulating battles between armies of miniature painted models. The franchise has a strong and loyal fan base, with some 4.7 million people estimated to use the Warhammer community website in 2021. Now the franchise is being turned into films and a television show, starring the actor Henry Cavill, who will also be the executive producer. Cavill, best known for playing Superman, is a lifelong fan of the game, which saw sales soar during lockdown, to the extent it's been reported the company's shares were at one point even outperforming those of Tesla. The deal between Games Workshop and the tech and media giant Amazon was first agreed in principle last December and has now been finalised. It's not yet known when the first projects will be out, though in a statement, Amazon said it will work with Games Workshop for 12 months to agree creative guidelines for both the films and the series.
Our gaming correspondent, Laura Kress. And that's all from us for now, but there will be a new edition of the Global News podcast later. If you want to comment on this podcast or the topics covered, you can send us an email. The address is globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk. You can also find us on X at Global News Pod. This edition was mixed by Carolyn Driscoll. The producer was Liam McSheffrey. The editor is Karen Martin. I'm Janat Jalil. Until next time, goodbye.